It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Out of the many disturbing and gruesome crime scene images in 15-year-old Karen Stitt's case file, one photo stands out. The picture shows a teenage Karen sitting near a blue and foamy ocean, her smile just as warm and bright as the beach surroundings. No longer with us today, the memory of Karen's sunny personality is frozen in time. On September 1st, 1982, Karen was out with her boyfriend for the night playing video games at the local 7-Eleven. Just after midnight, Karen's boyfriend realized he was past curfew, so he dropped Karen off at the bus stop on the busy El Camino Real, a bus line she regularly traveled. Tragically, she never made it home that night. Alongside a busy road of Sunnyvale, California, Karen disappeared. It wasn't until the next morning that her body was found. I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast. During the morning hours of September 2nd, 1982, a delivery man discovered the horrible scene. Karen's body was thrown behind a wall of a restaurant, roughly 100 yards away from the bus stop. She was found nude and bound with her own clothes. She had been raped and stabbed 59 times. The violent and seemingly random nature of Karen's attack shocked the community of Sunnyvale. For 40 years, Karen's brutal murder haunted the over 20 detectives who worked on her case and the community at large. For years, investigators pored over the case, interviewing friends, family, and others in the area. However, no significant leads emerged within the case. When Detective Matt Hutchison saw Karen's photo on the beach, her smile full of life, he knew it was his duty to bring this young victim justice. Through creative thinking and savvy investigative skills and an unmatched tenacity, Detective Hutchison used investigative genetic genealogy to track down distant relatives of the murderer. After years of determination, Detective Hutchison flew from California all the way to Maui, Hawaii, to arrest the suspected murderer in this decades-old cold case. Today, Detective Matt Hutchison joins me to discuss the incredible story behind bringing justice to 15-year-old Karen Stitt after more than 40 years.
I've been a detective going on almost 10 years now, and we've had a number of cold cases, and really there was nobody working them. We're just not assigning them. And we're not having a dedicated cold case detective. So I took it upon myself to just familiarize myself with all of the cases. And when I read Karen Stitt's case, she obviously stands out quite a bit. She's a 15-year-old girl, brutally murdered, bound, sexually assaulted, and found dumped nude. And all the cases matter, of course, but if you can't get motivated to work a case like that, I think you're in the wrong profession. In addition to just the victimology of the case, it stood out to me because she was dumped at a miniature golf location that I went to for teen parties and birthday parties, all growing up in Sunnyvale. And it's an intersection I drive past every day on my way to work. And so she kept reminding me over and over again, work my case. And so that's what I did.
And Detective, had you heard about, you know, her murder took place in 1982? Was it one that you were familiar with even before becoming a detective and sort of forming this cold case attention? Were you aware of it prior to then as a sort of homegrown kid from there?
A little bit. So I knew in passing about different cold cases we had, and people would always talk about her case because it is the most violent and it's the one that's most shocking. But my stepfather also worked for the city of Sunnyvale as an officer and then a lieutenant before he retired. And when I became a detective, he kept poking me. You need to work the Carrot Stick case. You need to work the Carrot Stick case. And he would remember elements of it, but not all of it. I think he remembered mostly how much it haunted him and a lot of the friends that he had that worked in, during that generation. And so it was nice to have kind of a family connection and be able to bring closure, not just to her family, but to mine as well.
Share with us the details, these gruesome details of the murder of Karen Stitt. What you knew when you took up the case as a detective, what did the department know at that point? What had happened to Karen Stitt?
So we knew that she lived in Palo Alto, which is a couple cities up the road from us. There's El Camino Real is a major thoroughfare that connects a bunch of cities in the Silicon Valley, where Sunnyvale is located. And she would take the bus up and down El Camino to visit her boyfriend. And she's 15 years old, stays out late with her boyfriend one night, and he looks at his watch and says, "Oh no, I'm up against curfew. I gotta let you go." And gives her a goodbye and leaves her close to the bus stop so she can get back on that bus and ride back to Palo Alto. She obviously never made it home. She was found in an alleyway between a miniature golf and garden center and a strip mall. And she was found stuffed behind a row of bushes, bound with her own clothing, stabbed nearly 60 times in the chest and neck, and found nude. So we had very little at the point in 1982 to go off of. Obviously, they weren't working with DNA the way that we're using it today. They started with her close circle of friends, her boyfriend, her family, to get a pattern of life to try to figure out if anybody would have targeted her, but no leads were developed.
And can you talk about, Detective, what was that area like at that time? You know, was it safe for teens to be alone? What's the demographic like? Under the circumstances, was it shocking in and of itself that a 15-year-old was taking the bus on El Camino Real? Or was that the norm in that neighborhood and a crime of this nature was shocking beyond being shocking in and of itself? But describe that climate.
Sure. So Sunnyvale has always been considered a relatively safe city. We have a low crime rate, especially violent crime. Even in 1982, it was low. So it wouldn't have been uncommon for kids of that age to take a bus up and down El Camino to visit each other. That wasn't necessarily shocking. What was shocking, like you're talking about, is the level of violence and no obvious connection between a victim and a possible suspect. A lot of times when somebody's killed violently, it's somebody within their circle or somebody that they interacted with, and we can track back to that. This seemed like a completely random stranger attack, which are more rare when we're investigating these types of cases, and they're obviously more difficult to solve because you don't have a starting point.
And when you talk about the stab 60 times, I mean, that to me portrays a level of anger or rage or passion that is, you know, beyond, just above and beyond. What other aspects of the discovery of her body, the nature, the circumstances, what things did you glean from that? What did that tell you, or does that tell you about who might have been responsible?
There's a level of sophistication to this case because she had to be abducted from a major intersection where you would anticipate that there would have been traffic. So somebody is confident in their abilities to be able to take her from where she was taken, do what they did, and then discard her the way that they did. Very callous. From the beginning, looking at the scene photos, looking at the autopsy report, things like that, it's always been in my head that this person could have committed multiple crimes. And maybe just hasn't been caught yet. So it's something I'm looking at constantly. Is there a way to connect this person with anybody else, any other victims out there that are waiting on an answer as well?
And sir, did you had that conclusion because you said of sort of the audacity, the sophistication of this person abducting someone in such a public area? Or were there other things about this crime that made you think this was a serial violent?
It's kind of the totality of the circumstances. First off, being that she was abducted from a busy intersection, an area that should have had traffic. It's a gutsy move for somebody to commit that type of a crime. Then the level of violence. The fact that she was discarded and tried to be concealed in a certain way, the fact that she was bound. I've seen other homicides or sexual assaults where there's an opportunity and a suspect attacks a person and it gets violent right there in the street, and that's where the scene is. We weren't able to locate the actual scene of the murder where you would expect to see all the blood. We found her where she was discarded, a short distance away from where she was last seen. But because we don't have a trail of blood or a big blood pool or a violent scene, it leads me to believe that she was also put into a vehicle or some other way that she was concealed, which again speaks to the sophistication of the suspect and his comfort in doing what he did.
So back to 1982, and you mentioned her boyfriend and those that were sort of immediately considered and ruled out. Was that a quick process? At that time in 1982, was the boyfriend and others quickly ruled out and it became sort of immediately a cold case?
No, I would say that the investigation focused on her close circle for quite a bit of time. Again, how I mentioned DNA not being used then the way it's used now, there wasn't a quick test that you could do to see if his biological samples were at the scene. And so he's the last person that's seen with her and they can't identify anybody else. They focused on him for quite a bit of time. And I know just speaking with him that must have been extremely difficult for him to always be looked at like a suspect. So getting an answer meant a lot to him as well.
Right. I think about, you know, that 20 detectives handled this case before you or at least, and how you inherit what seems like a closed universe. You know, those photographs that were taken of the crime scene, there's no additional photographs you could ever take or do. Tell us about that process. Tell us about the exhaustion of people being interviewed that you encountered, how you were able to resurrect evidence as beneficial, as important to you. Tell us what that process looked like when you then got this case.
So one of the first things I do is I try to block out those previous detectives as much as I appreciate them, and they did help advance the case and they did great work. I don't like to listen to any of their previous theories, because if you're going to go down the same exact path, we're going to end at the same place. And so I just try to read the case with no preconceived notions. I stare at the scene photos and I just study them over and over and over again. And I just look for things that haven't been done yet or haven't been tried yet. So as I'm reading a case, I'm sitting with a notepad and I'm just writing notes. Did they do this? Did they talk to that person? And, you know, a lot of times you get 30 pages into the report and you find out that they did, you just cross it off your list. But at the end of it, I'm hoping I have 100 things that I can go and do and try to advance that ball. I look at all these cases hoping to solve them, but being realistic, knowing that some of them may be difficult, but I can probably leave them better than I found them. And anything that I do may make it easier for the next guy or gal who works these cases. So I'm just trying to stay busy and try to stay active on these cases. And sometimes those things lead to leads that break the case wide open. And now you're running 100 miles an hour trying to catch up. In 1982, we were fortunate in Sunnyvale because we started a CSI program, crime scene investigators, fairly early in the late 70s. And although they didn't always know exactly what they were collecting, they were evidence minded and they were careful to preserve things at the scene. And so they preserved a blood stain that was on a wall above where she was dropped and discarded. And that blood sample remained in evidence since 1982. And it's been tested previous to me to taking over the case, and they developed a full DNA profile. So where I started, I was fortunate because I had an unknown blood sample in my crime scene from a male right above where my victim was found. So now it's a full court press, not only to identify who's the source of that blood, but also, can we strengthen that evidence? Can we take blood from above where she's found? Is there any blood on her? Is there any semen inside of her? Is there any other evidence connecting that blood sample to the victim? So I always look at a case and I try to establish a relationship between three things: the victim, the offender, and the scene. Is there something in my scene that both the victim and the offender touched or interacted with, or something that the offender discarded while he was attacking my victim, I'm always looking for that item to see if I can develop a case that way. And so in this case, that blood was the first piece.
So you've described that it was your understanding that she was probably killed elsewhere, given the lack of blood splatter commensurate with her stab wounds where she was dropped. For there to be blood stains of the perp above where she was dropped, what does that tell you about how that could have happened? Did she fight back? Was he bleeding from something else? How do you think that deposit was left above where she was dropped?
So what we find is actually common in stabbings is that a lot of times a suspect's hand will slip onto the blade of the knife, especially with a scene that's very, very bloody. And with 60 stab wounds, she's bleeding quite a bit. And so blood is slippery. It's not just like water. And so it's common for the hand to slip off the grip of the knife onto the blade, and suspects sometimes cut themselves. And the wall that the blood was on was on the side where we believe she was discarded from, over the wall. It would have been like a 2 or 3 foot wall. So it's reasonable to believe that he could have committed this crime inside of a vehicle, backed up to this wall and tried to push her over it to conceal her. And as he's doing that, he's leaning over the wall. If he's bleeding, his blood's deposited on the wall. It also is very possible that she fought back from the descriptions of people that knew her well. She didn't put up with a lot, and she would talk back. She would defend herself, and she was tough for her age. And so if I got a vote, I hope she fought back, and I hope she punched him in the face.
We're going to take a quick break. More from our guest after this.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Okay, so walk me through what happened next with the blood sample of the perp.
So the blood sample in the 2000s, early 2000s, it was entered into what we call CODIS. It's a database of known offenders that have been arrested for serious crimes. They get their DNA tested incident to arrest or sometimes after conviction and put into a database. So our blood sample is in CODIS, and it's constantly trying to match off of people who have either already been arrested or have been arrested more recently, and then they go to the database and it's constantly refreshing. But we're getting no matches. Nothing's coming back as a hit. So then we tried what's called familial searching. The California Department of Justice has the ability to search for like first degree relatives, so parent child or direct biological siblings through familial matching. So if my full biological brother committed a terrible crime and I'm in the system somehow for being arrested, they can use me to help work back to identify him. So you have to request that on an annual basis. You can't just plug it in like CODIS and have it refresh constantly. We did that multiple times and still we're getting no matches. This is right around the time of the Golden State Killer being caught and announced and the methods that they used being announced. And it was really fortunate for me because I wanted to do genealogy on this case for probably 4 or 5 months before the Golden State Killer was announced. And then when it was announced, it gave me the ability to go to the district attorney's office and say, hey, if they can do it, there's no reason we can't do it. And there's no reason we shouldn't do it on this case because we've exhausted everything else. We have to do this for this victim. And fortunately, the DA's office is very supportive in Santa Clara County. They have a cold case prosecutor who helps guide investigations from beginning to the end and give advice to officers, guidance. And they took up the case and said, yeah, absolutely. Let's do genealogy. And so when a blood sample is tested for a criminal sample at a criminal lab, they look for different markers than a genealogical lab might look for. When you or I or anybody else does one of the main genealogical labs out there, they're testing the DNA much differently. So to take my criminal blood sample from my crime scene and get it into a genealogical database meant we had to send it to a different kind of lab and have it kind of reanalyzed. That lab then does what they call a snapshot. of the DNA. They give you an idea of where it comes back from geographically and what your pool of suspects might be racially. They try and look in public databases for genetic matches to your profile. And at that point, the best that we had was third cousins. And the genealogical lab, unfortunately, told us it's probably not worth your time. You're probably not going to ever solve it. So we're going to move on.
When you submit to the district attorney's office that you want to have familial genealogy assessed here, are you asking them, do they need to sign off on the resource allocation for it or on the evidentiary threshold that they will accept, including this potential for evidence sort of recovery or identification?
So it's a little bit of both. At that stage, it was pretty early on with genealogy. So my county, Santa Clara County, hadn't done a genealogy case before. So we really needed to make sure that they were going to be on board with whatever evidence it turned up if it led us to a suspect. Ultimately, what we do is we still get a one-to-one sample. We don't rely on what the genealogy says. We're still going to put a swab inside the suspect's cheek or draw blood and do a one-to-one comparison through our crime lab that developed the initial profile. So ultimately, the genealogy is a tool to try to get us to that point where we do a one-to-one comparison. But then also it is resource allocation as well, because Sunnyvale is a relatively small agency. We only have 10 detectives, mostly. We have 12 now, but that's just because we've gotten some staffing back. And to go to your supervisors and say, hey, we need X amount of $1,000 to go and do genealogy and something they've never heard of before is difficult. So you need to have buy-in from the district attorney's office. They've helped share costs on these things quite a bit, which is huge, because it makes it easier to make the arguments to my chief that, hey, I need a bunch of money to do this thing that is not really in your realm, in your mindset as a chief, because you're managing the organization, not thinking about evidence. So it's a little bit of both.
And the reason that I ask is because I think it's important for me and for listeners to understand, if it's a resource issue, this is how we and what we should know so that we can petition and vote and lobby and raise import about. You know, I want to know if people who are trying to solve crimes don't have the resources to do so. I want to know if my tax dollars are not completing the job, right? So they say third cousins, it's not worth your time. Then what happens?
There was definitely a period of time that was, I was pretty low on the case. And I thought, well, if these genealogist people are the experts and they're saying I'm never going to solve it, then I'm never going to solve it. And what do I do? And so I took some time with that, and I kept driving past that intersection every day. I kept looking at her picture on my desk, and I said, that's not good enough. If that was my sister, if that was my wife, my cousin, whoever I care about, I wouldn't accept the excuse that it was hard, so I just didn't try. And so we believe that probably third cousins aren't going to know who the suspect was. I don't know any of my third cousins. I don't know a lot of people that do unless they do genealogy. So we had to take a little bit of risk, and that meant contacting those third cousins individually and saying, will you tell me as much as you know about your family? Will you identify as many people on your family tree as you possibly can? Because in my mind at that point, he's somewhere on that family tree. My suspect is somewhere in there. They may not know who he is. I may not know who he is, but the more people I can put on that family tree and the bigger that family tree gets, the better chance we have of potentially solving it someday. And again, it may not be me, but I don't mind passing the baton to somebody else because it's about Karen. It's not about me. And so we started contacting them one by one. The first third cousin lived in a major metropolitan area in Mexico, and he didn't know any relatives that had ever been to the United States. He said, look, I'll help you with everything I can, but I don't know any relatives that have ever been to the United States. Here's all my matches, which was helpful. I mean, it would have been great if he said, yeah, you should look at my third cousin, so-and-so.
Detective, what do you mean by here are all my matches? What do you mean by him saying that?
Sure. So when you take a genealogical test, if you use one of the companies like Ancestry or 23andMe, they're going to spit back out genetic relatives to you. And they're going to say, hey, this person shares this much DNA with you, and based on how much DNA that they share with you, we believe they're a second cousin, a third cousin. Maybe they're a long lost brother or sister you never knew you had, or maybe you've been looking for. And so that gentleman in Mexico was awesome because he said to me, "You can have anybody I've ever matched with on a genetic level. I'll tell you every name on my list," which for me at that point, we're just trying to get as much data as we possibly can, because the genealogists that are going to help us are going to be, the more they're armed with, the better work that they can do. If I start from zero, then I'm not helping.
And to be clear, the reason that he has to share his matches with you is because those large DNA collection ancestry platforms do not have a shared information bottom line or neutral position with law enforcement. So when we talk about culling your DNA and giving it to law enforcement having access, first of all, that's something you have to toggle to approve. And secondly, it is not on Ancestry.com or 23andMe or the sites that you give each other for Christmas. So the reason he had to identify those matches for you is because you, as law enforcement, could not access it on your own. Is that accurate?
That's 100% correct. I know a lot of people are worried about taking those tests and then like, oh, well, the cops are just in those databases. They look around all the time. That's not true. I always give people this example. Emily, if you and I were long lost cousins and didn't know it, and you took an ancestry test and I took a 23andMe test, those companies don't communicate with one another either because they'd like you to buy their test. And so there was a third party website that was created, and it became a repository for DNA data because the creator of that website said, hey, if you paid 23andMe, if you paid Ancestry, you own your DNA data. You should be able to dump it into a system that can read it and match with the other companies. And so that database is where law enforcement can sometimes go. And even in that database, there's an affirmative checkbox that says, yes, I'm willing to match with law enforcement. So the fears that Big Brother is watching and the cops are just messing with these databases is just not true. We're not able to go in there and search haphazardly or wherever we want. So yeah, we have to rely on the cooperation of others to give us their data if they're willing.
So third cousin in Mexico gave you all his matches. And then where did you go from there?
So we went to the next two third cousins both lived in Texas, and both of them were willing to meet with us, which was fortunate. One of them, unfortunately, was the product of a closed adoption in El Paso. So he said, listen, you can have all my data as well. I'll give you every match that I've got, but I don't even know who my mom is. And maybe in your searching for this suspect, you can help me find my mom.
Right.
And so we compelled the court that held his adoption record to open it for us and give it to us via search warrant. And unfortunately, the details in the adoption were so sparse that he was a dead end as well. We couldn't identify anybody through him. Unfortunately, I couldn't help him find his mom either. I was hoping that would be a part of the story at some point, but it didn't work out. The third cousin lived in a very small town in Texas. She was apprehensive about meeting with us. She said, okay, I'll meet with you, but at the police station. And it's the type of police station where it's like the person at the front counter is the county clerk for the courthouse and the person that can sign off tickets, and they do traffic control and it's like one-stop shop. I think they had like three or four officers and the chief was out there in traffic control. So it kind of tells you how small that area is. And she met with us, verified who we were and what we were really there to do. I explained a little bit about our victim to her and told her what the case was. And she said, well, we can't work here. Why don't you come back home with me and we'll really work out all the matches. She had done a lot of genealogy work on her own. And she's a member of the LDS church, and genealogy is very common in the religion. And so she had tons of matches, thousands of matches, really. And so we came armed with reams of butcher paper and we rolled them out on her kitchen table. She logged into her different ancestry websites and we drew it out by hand and just started labeling every family member that we could find. And at the end of spending a few hours with her at her kitchen table, she made us dinner and sent us off with all her matches, and she was a huge help. She actually, if I could deputize her and make her a detective, she would be great. She stuck with me throughout the entire case. We would communicate every once in a while, and she'd say, hey, I just got an update from the website, and I got these many more matches here. You can have them. So she was awesome. But again, very, very distant to our suspect, and it didn't result in a hit to our suspect group. So we were still kind of in the dark.
Did you ascertain that by all of those hours and hours and hours worth of names that you wrote down? You just went in one by one and looked them up and saw if what they shared, or you looked at their alibi of that night, or how did you eliminate these hundreds of people or thousands of people?
Yeah. So the first thing we had to do was kind of come up with a geographic profile. Could any of these people been in Sunnyvale in 1982? If they lived in Texas their whole life, probably not. If they were across the country on the East Coast, probably not. Were they right in the right age range to be our suspect? How complete was her family tree? We knew that he was somewhere on there, but we just didn't know if he was one of the names that she had written down. Ultimately, when we go through those all one by one, you know, we're able to eliminate essentially 50% of them right off the bat, because we know our offender that matches that blood stain is not a female. So we take out all the males, and then we look at, okay, which of these males are in the right age range? Which of these males had a connection to Sunnyvale, or at least close enough by that we think that they could have been going up and down El Camino? And there were a handful that stuck out, and we would go out to them and try and get their DNA, either through cooperation, if we thought they were far enough removed, or surreptitiously, or through secret, if we didn't think that they, if we thought they might be the suspect. We obviously didn't want to tell them, hey, we're looking at you. So we would do it surreptitiously.
Before we get into what surreptitiously and secrecy, what those methods looked like for you legally and practically, when you say ruled out age-wise, was there a maximum age? Because I can understand you're like, okay, this guy was 10 at the time in 1982. That's not him. But I always right. think of, you know, we've read enough books, or we've read about that there are elderly perps also. What was the age range you included then?
We put a pretty high cap on it when we were at that stage of the investigation, because we didn't want to limit things. So I was still looking at people in their 70s, knowing that the further they get, maybe they wouldn't have been as physically able to overpower her, but also knowing that he's armed with a weapon, and a weapon is a great equalizer for things like that. And so I didn't want to limit it too much, but I also needed to limit it to some degree, because I had to have a chunk of data that I could actually work with. But the plan was always to go back and expand the age window if I needed to.
This is like the first pass. So yep. Tell us about the surreptitious DNA collection and what that looked like for you as a detective.
So one of the common ways that we do, and it's actually how we work back to our suspect at a point, was through trash collections. So the Supreme Court has ruled that when the can goes out to the curb, it's discarded property, and there's no longer an expectation of privacy over it. There's certain states that have made their own laws saying that you can't do that, and have kind of said we don't agree with the Supreme Court's interpretation. But in California, it's still allowed. Another method we do is, in this case, I actually utilized it, was I got a suspect I was dealing with. I interacted with him under a ruse, talking about a completely different, unrelated event. And I basically convinced him that he might be the victim of fraud. And in order for me to protect him on that fraud, I needed to investigate it. And would you mind filling out this form and sending it back for me? And when he did, he licked the envelope to seal the envelope and send it back to me. So I had his DNA that way.
And is that fully legal all the time? That you can always, it reminds me of remember the Super Bowl? You won tickets to the Super Bowl, and then all the perps get in the room, they arrest them. But at the end of the day, the question is, can you tell for viewers or listeners, what is the legality of pretend identities and pretend ruses? Are those always legal for DNA collection?
There's certain caveats. Like, I can't trick my way into his house and go into his drawers or take his toothbrush out of his bathroom. That would be more of a search I'd have to have a search warrant. But if first off, but the police are allowed to lie. We don't always have to tell the truth. And the intrusion of that, giving him the ability to either seal the envelope or not seal the envelope or participate or not participate, is what helped that stay above board and make it legal. But that's ultimately the biggest benefit of our model in Santa Clara County, of having a district attorney walk us through the case and be on board with us throughout, is I can go to that district attorney and say, hey, this is my idea on this. What do you think? And there's times they go, hey, settle down. And they pull me by the back of the collar and say, we're not doing that. Let's think twice. And then there's other times they think, oh, that's creative. Let's do it. And so I don't ever go on my own. I don't have a law degree. I haven't taken the bar. I've got enough to do to try to be an expert in police and fire in Sunnyvale. I got to rely on the people that actually went to the school for that kind of stuff. And I always bounce things off of them before I try.
And on that note, I want listeners to also understand that if they're saying, because you mentioned before how states can do their own thing aside from the Supreme Court trash, you know, discarding comment, states can make more restrictive laws. They cannot create less restrictive laws than a federal law or precedent. So that's how states get away with saying, nope, here, we protect privacy more, just in case anyone's wondering about that conflict, which I think also is really interesting. More of the Fox True Crime Podcast coming up. I'm loving this story so much. I love your creativity and how you did. So, all right. So this guy, he licks the envelope. And then who's next? And how did you get their DNA?
There's a brief pause in the story because Sunnyvale does both police and fire. We're a public safety department. And I ran out of time as a detective. And they said, okay, you get 5 years in the assignment. And then we rotate new people through and you're out. And I'm in the middle of this case. And so I said, well, you can't have anybody else start from scratch on this. It means too much to me. Let me take it to the firehouse with me. And I went and I worked in the firehouse and I just kept building the family trees and trying to put more people on the family trees during our downtime between calls and things like that from the firehouse. And I'm in the firehouse and I get contacted by one of my former supervisors in investigations. And he says, hey, we're doing a summer lecture series at the library and here's all the topics. We want you to teach DNA. Will you come and do a 1 hour speaking thing to members of the public on DNA and how we use it? Like, yeah, sure. We'll do it. And I went and I told kind of bare bones how we look at DNA and how we use it. And three ladies came up to me after the presentation and they said, are you doing any cases with genealogy? So why do you ask? And they said, well, we're professional genealogists. This is what we love to do. We've traced our DNA back to the American Revolution and it's just interesting to us and we want to help. And I think it would be easy for cops sometimes to go, well, you're a civilian. I'm not going to let you look at my case file or we're not going to work together on this. But to me, I don't know what a third cousin twice removed is or what all that means in genealogy speak. So I signed them up and they became volunteers for the department and they started working the family trees and they can dive down way deeper into the DNA and look at it and go, okay, if they share this much DNA total, but the longest portion of their DNA is that's shared is this much, they can start to glean from that and go, all right, well, this person's not a match, but their cousin might be, or their uncle might be. And so they really looked at the relationships and started trying to find either points in my family tree that were blank and we needed to add a branch by finding out who was related in there, or points in my family tree that might be an intersection between two families that could tell us where we need to go next. Fortunately, I got done with my fire assignment and there was an opening investigations again. And I applied and went through the interview process and they said, okay, you can come back. And I started working the cases again. And the genealogist had made some progress in between. And we got to the point where they said, okay, there's a guy in San Jose, which is a town not far from us. It's one town over. If you go and you get his DNA and we test it, I think it'll tell us if we need to be looking at his dad and his uncles, or if we need to be looking at his cousins. We think we're getting in close. And as soon as they tell me they think we're getting in close, it keys me in to say, all right, well, it's got to be surreptitious. Then I can't go ring this guy's doorbell and ask him for it because it's going to set off alarms. I always work under the belief that this could be some family secret that multiple people know about, and they're going to rally the wagons and protect the bad guy. So we got to do it surreptitiously. So fortunately, he lived close enough by. We went out and got a surreptitious sample from him early one morning.
How did you do?
Trash. Okay. Yeah, we went and took his trash. So we'll sneak up and under color of darkness, take items out of the trash that we think that the would interact mostly with the person's mouth, like cans, bottles, things like that. But we'll take full bags out and we'll drive them back to the station and lay them out on a tarp and kind of comb through people's trash item by item and take as many as we can. And sent that off to our crime lab, had our crime lab compare it to the suspect sample that we already had. And the answer back from the crime lab was, okay, he's not your suspect, but he is a paternal relative, meaning he's related through his father's line of DNA. And there's DNA in common enough that we think it's a close relationship.
Detective, when that news came back, and now it's been 6-7 years later, what did that feel like for you? What did that feel like for you?
It's an energizing moment. It charges you up, but you temper it because these cold cases, they always have twists and turns and they're always disappointments. And I still don't know if my suspect's going to be alive. So you're excited, but you don't let yourself get too excited because you still have work to do. And so armed with that information, the genealogist looked at it and they said, okay, we're not looking at the cousins. We're looking at the uncles now. And that made our group of potential suspects much smaller, and they're all alive. And so I'm really excited because they're all viable. They're all people I can go out and get samples from. And so now it's a process of elimination. Assuming all the relatives are correct and there's not like a child out of wedlock that's hidden somewhere or not known about in the family tree, it's going to be one of these guys, and they're all close enough that I can reach out and touch them if I need to, and I can go and find them. And so we look at it and we go, all right, one by one, let's start. And so the match in San Jose fortunately also eliminated his father. So that cut the list down to three. One of them lived in North Las Vegas. One of them lived in Maine, and one of them lived in, or two of them live on Maui. The son of our San Jose subject and the uncle of our San Jose subject. If I went to my department and I said, please fly me to Hawaii as my first one, they would laugh at me and they'd say no. So
I promise, guys, he's in Maui. I promise. Here's the paperwork. I can't imagine.
Probably it's going to be him. they wouldn't believe me. So I had to start with the one that I could drive to, which meant North Las Vegas. And so a partner and I leave one day and drive out to North Las Vegas, actually stop on a separate cold case and interview somebody in a prison down on Highway 5 out in the middle of the valley.
I think I've been to that one. I know which one you're talking about. Yeah, totally. Totally.
Yeah. So we continue on to Vegas, get there just in time to basically have dinner and go to sleep because we got to be up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we wake up, find him, find his house. His trash is out there. We collect his trash. And the only place that we could think of that was going to be well lit and give us the space to look at the stuff was the roof of a casino parking lot. And so we roll it out on a tarp and we're going through it. We're packaging it and sealing it as evidence. And a security guard came up with his gun drawn. What are you guys doing up here? Hey, settle down. We're the police. I know it looks weird, but here's what we're doing. And I got through that and finished probably packaging and sealing everything at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And then headed all the way back straight to our crime lab and delivered the items to them and had that process done over where they do the direct comparison between that person and the suspect sample. They looked at it and within a short, maybe 10 days, 2 weeks period of time, they came back. And again, they said it's a paternal relative. So it's still connected to the father's line of DNA, to close relative, but it's not your suspect. So now we've eliminated two of the uncles and we're down to two, one in Maine and one in Maui. Each location presented different challenges. The location in Maine was pretty rural, kind of like a one lane country highway where it's not like I can just sit out there in a rental car and I'm not going to stick out like a sore thumb. It's a small town. I'll probably get made pretty quickly and people will start to ring the alarms. And then Maui was difficult as well because it's a tight-knit community. And I'm going to stick out in Maui as a tourist or a police officer going into certain neighborhoods, and I can't just interact there and hang out. And so we then looked at whether or not either of those people had biological children. The subject in Maine didn't have any biological kids, so we couldn't go get a sample of his kids as a reference for him. But the subject in Maui did. And his daughter lived in San Diego, California. So same plan as Las Vegas. We're going to drive down one night, fall asleep, wake up the next morning, and we're going to try to get her trash. Fortunately, we didn't have to sort it on a casino parking lot. We had a connection down with the San Diego County Sheriff's Office down there that let us into their headquarters so we could lay it out and actually do it in the controlled environment. And same thing, 4 o'clock in the morning, start driving north back with that evidence straight to our crime lab and deliver it to them. And when we did, they did their testing for the one-to-one comparison again. And the conclusion was that the female that we sampled in San Diego was probably, based on what they could see, was most probably the biological daughter of our suspect. So the excitement goes kind of shooting through the roof at that point, because it's like, holy cow, we went from impossible, I should call that lab and tell them they were wrong, to we have a chance at this thing. Then the job becomes convincing my department that I can fly to Maui with a bunch of detectives so we can get his sample and get him arrested.
How many years from the point that you got the case and the point that that familial genealogical lab said it's impossible was the time that you got the results back that it was probably that woman's biological dad? So we know how many years had passed.
So I would say it was probably 1 to 2 years between picking up the case for the first time and then getting the genealogical lab saying it's going to be a really tough ask. It's going to be hard to solve. And then another two and a half years to the actual like arrest, and we have the right guy. So the arrest came maybe 3 or 4 months after getting that match to his biological daughter. So it's 4.5 years total span. And that genealogical lab came at 2 years in, probably telling us, good luck. It's going to be tough.
Right. Okay. So you're in front of your chief and you're like, send me to Maui. You probably have our guy. Then what happens?
So they had to do some thinking, because they're going to justify sending 3 detectives to Hawaii. We're going to send some district attorney investigators and all this other stuff. And, you know, part of the problem is that this is not the chief's realm, and it shouldn't be. The chief shouldn't be down in the weeds knowing every little thing. He's got to manage the organization. But ultimately, I think what gets traction with departments on these, and this would be for your listeners as well, if they have a loved one and they're waiting for an answer, is you have to humanize these cases. You have to remind the chief that this is not just genealogy says this. This is a 15-year-old girl named Karen who had the rest of her life promised to her and it was stolen. And we owe her our best. And we can't quit because it's going to be expensive at this point. We just moved a mountain to get to a suspect. I'm going. And to my department's credit, they heard the message loud and clear. And they said, come up with a plan that makes sense. Come up with a plan that's legal, that you're not going to be out in another state, an ocean away, and we can't help you. We can't protect you. And also do it without a supervisor, because we're short staffed and you're on your own once you get out there. And so we worked closely with the FBI in Maui, and they have what's called task force officers with local police departments that they'll kind of absorb into a task force and kind of give them some of their federal access, but also help them with local state problems. And there was a task force officer who was assigned to that area in Maui that was trusted and very well respected. And so he and I started talking and brainstorming ideas of how do I get face to face with this person and put the handcuffs on him and get his DNA sample. And so again, I got a little creative and I came up with a ruse. I asked the Maui detective, I said, can you please call him, say that patrol guys just made a car stop. The car was full of stolen mail and social security numbers. and they've got your information. Just to see if he'll take the bait and confirm his home, confirm his address, confirm his phone number so we know where he'll be. And he took the bait. He said, yeah, that's my phone number. That's who I am. I live at this address. And I said, all right, schedule a meeting with him. Let him think he's going to go over the materials and be able to see him and deal with that potential identity theft issue. But he's going to meet me instead. And so sure enough, he took the bait, scheduled a meeting. And I went back to my department and I said, this is the date. He's ready. He'll be waiting for me. We have the buy-in of all these FBI agents that are going to be there to support the operation. We have the local police department that's going to support it. And you need to send me. I need to be on an airplane. And they did. And so I flew over there with three Sunnyvale detectives, two Santa Clara County district attorney investigators, or basically detectives that work for the district attorney's office. We met. Well, man, the FBI ran strong. They probably sent us 7 or 8 agents at a different point, and then a few Maui detectives. And so we got there the day before the scheduled meeting, and we were doing a briefing with all the people who were going to be involved in the operation the next day. And the suspect called the Maui detective and said, you know what? I don't want to meet tomorrow. Can we just meet now? And so for me, we looked across the table at everybody and everybody said, this is the opportunity. We'll call our wives. We'll call our husbands. We'll tell them we're going to be late tonight. And we all just mounted up from right then and drove out to his house and just kind of did it impromptu.
Are you driving out to his house with all of those people you just named, with like a line of I'm picturing black SUVs, 7, 8 FBI, you and your super, like, I mean, is that how many people rolled up into his compound? Or was it just you driving up one car and everyone else was far behind? I have to picture it in my head.
So we staggered it a little bit. We sent most of the FBI agents with the Sunnyvale detectives ahead of time. And we put them, there was a school or something like that nearby. We had them staged near the school. And then I drove with the Maui detective and we just communicated over radio and said, all right, we're going to drive into the location. You guys hold back and we'll call you in when we need you, because if all those conga line of cars come driving down his block, he may not come out to speak with me. And I needed to get eyes on him to positively identify him. And I needed to get him in custody, under arrest, without having any kind of incident. Cause the direction from my department was very clear. Don't go over there and have a problem. Don't embarrass us. Don't get in a fight. Don't go chasing this old man over a fence. Don't do anything stupid, kind of a thing.
How old was he at the time? How old was this
person? He was in his 70s.
Okay.
And so when we pulled up, fortunately, he was outside standing next to a car. And so it made it really easy for me. I was able to confirm who he was. And he wanted to talk about the identity theft. And I was able to tell him right then and there, I'm actually from Sunnyvale, California, and you're under arrest for the murder of Karen Stitt.
We'll be right back with more of this story. In that moment, detective, what was his facial expression? Was he caught? Guilty. I knew it. Not surprised. What did you see flash across his face?
I could see the wheels spinning. So there was like a brief period where he's thinking and you can see him processing the information. And then it was almost like a switch flipped to, I should act surprised and say, you got the wrong guy. And it was, I mean, I to give my own opinion, I thought it was fake. I thought it was kind of a rehearse. Oh, me? What are you talking about? Not genuine. I think that he was waiting for that moment to come for a long time in his life. And it finally came and he didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah, it did. Courtesy of the red, white, and blue and the Sunnyvale PD. Detective Hutcherson, I just love this story so much because finally, decades later, a 15-year-old, her brutal murder was avenged, at least in that moment. You know, that's the whole point, that for decades, a family lost a loved one and a poor young girl had her life extinguished by someone who thought she was discardable.
Yeah.
Not on your watch. So you take him into custody there.
We take him into custody there. We call in the rest of the group because I had a plan in place that anybody that was at the house, we needed to interview them. We needed to try to serve a search warrant at the house. There's some issues with serving a warrant out of state. I can't go into Hawaii with a California warrant and tell them I'm going to search this residence. They don't have to, the legal system there doesn't have to recognize a California warrant. So we had to get a Maui prosecutor to sign off on the warrant. And one of the things that we wanted to find was historical information that would show where this person lived throughout their life, because that belief still is in my head that he could have committed more crimes. And one of the ways that I wanted to do that was through pictures and documents and things like that, and electronics. And the response I got from the Maui prosecutor was, hey, great that you're working this case. I appreciate that. But you don't know for a fact that he's going to have those items in his house. So I can't authorize you searching for them, which, without getting into a legal discussion, I don't have to know for a fact that he would have those. It just has to be probable. And based on all my previous searching of houses, it's probable that people are going to have photos. It's probable that they're going to have written documents that I can review and see if they're relevant to my case. But ultimately, the prosecutor felt more comfortable if we could view those items in the house and then reapply for the search warrant. So when we arrested him, I could look through his front window into his bedroom and his like high school graduation panoramic photo of his whole graduating class was on the wall above his bed. So we were able to call the prosecutor and say, okay, he's got the photos. I can see them in plain view. I'm not going in there and searching. I can see it from the outside. Will you grant the search warrant? And he did. So now we have suspect in custody. I have to interview him and try to get as much as I can. We have to search that house. We have to interview everybody that we can that's close by there, that's associated to him, either living there or his brother who lives not far from there. And we got to get his DNA and we got to get it back to California right now. So one of the detectives that flew out with me, she's one of my favorite people in the world. She wouldn't want her name listed on here, but she was willing to fly out to Maui with us. She landed that night. We got the suspect's DNA 3 hours later. She was on the first flight out of Maui the next morning, taking the DNA back to our crime lab, hand delivered it to our crime lab. And then they stayed open around the clock overnight to just work only this case, because the district attorney's office said, hey, you go out there and you do what you need to do. We're not going to extradite him and bring him back to California until you get that one-to-one DNA match. So you got to get the DNA back for us. And so my partner did that. She flew it back the next morning while we dealt with the search and the interviews and all that stuff that we had to do. I'll tell you what happened with the DNA, but just that night, one of my main goals in interviewing him was, again, that geographic profile and that timeline of his life to show where he might have lived so that we could communicate with other agencies and try to develop other cases if they were viable. And then obviously to confront him on the Karen Stitt case as well. So we were able to get through quite a bit about his history. And then at the point that there was a confrontation about the case that I was investigating, he invoked his right to an attorney, and I had to be done.
And when you say confrontation, as in you brought it up, or as in there was there some type of altercation, or it got heated, or?
Just confrontation, just in the sense that now we're not talking about things more globally or things that he's comfortable just discussing. Now we're talking specifically about why I flew all the way out to Maui and why he's in custody. And I think at that point, the confrontation happens with some of the evidence. Hey, that swab that was just taken from you is flying back to California right now, and I know what the answer is going to be. And then there was a shutdown of the interview because he wanted an attorney.
Did you see any visible scars on his hands?
No, there was maybe one kind of a scratch on his hand, but nothing that I could say that happened in 1982 that was connected. No.
All right, Detective, what is the epilogue in this case?
So the evidence gets flown back to California. The lab stays open all night. I'm asleep in a hotel room with my laptop open, just no screensaver, just the light shining on me. And for whatever reason, I woke up at like 3 o'clock in the morning, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I was just awake. And I said, maybe it's there. Maybe the answer is there. And I clicked on it. And sure enough, there was an email from the crime lab saying you have a one-to-one match. I think it was 24.1, one in 24.1 septillion chance that it could be anybody else. So I got through the moment where I wanted to scream and yell and bang on everybody's doors and wake them up. And then I had to Google what 24.1 septillion is, because it's just a gigantic number. But that was the answer. That was, you found the guy who killed Karen Stitt. Extremely rewarding moment. Then, you know, the work is done in the sense of investigation that we can do out in Maui, but the case isn't over. Now I need to call her boyfriend and I need to let him know that we found him and it's not you. I need to call her surviving family members and let them know we found him and he's in custody and he's not going to get away with it. You get through those moments and now it's working with the district attorney's office from here on out to try to just make sure that we can keep the case as strong as it possibly can be and make sure that he doesn't see the law. So a few weeks after the arrest, we got a call from Maui saying he's waived extradition. He signed the paperwork saying he'll go with you. And I got to fly back again and bring him back on an airplane and book him into our jail, which it's kind of these incremental moments of satisfaction and positive outcomes with the case. And now he's in custody in Santa Clara County and he's awaiting preliminary hearing and awaiting trial eventually. But the work hasn't stopped. We've submitted more evidence to the crime lab. We've identified more blood at the scene as belonging to him. We've identified his blood again on our victim, and we identified his semen inside of her.
What was the reaction when you told him of the then boyfriend of Karen Stitt? What did he say when you called him?
I could tell it was very emotional for him. He's got children, and he said that having lived through this event and the suspicion on him and just kind of the beating himself up for not staying with her at the bus stop and things like that has really affected his life, not only at that time, but also how he parents and how he interacts with his children and how he kind of views the world and the dangers that they might see. And so it was a big moment for him. My biggest regret in notifying family members is that I wasn't able to solve it before her father passed. Her father passed a few years before I was able to solve the case. And, you know, to your listeners, if any of them are law enforcement, that feeling is horrible, that it doesn't get worse than that. So don't sit on these cases, work them, because your witnesses, your victims' families, your suspects, they're all getting older and they're going to die. And you're not going to forgive yourself if you fooled around and didn't work these cases as much as you possibly could.
Do you have a few words, Detective, about who Karen Stitt was? You mentioned that she was strong and independent. Can you just share a little bit about who she was as we close today?
Yeah, for a long time, when I would think of Karen Stitt, the only thing I'd be able to see was the scene photos and see her brutalized and lifeless. And there was a photo in the case file of Karen sitting on a beach, kind of sideways, with the wind in her hair, smiling wide and just being full of life. And that's how I see her now when I think about this case, because that's who she was and that's who she deserved to be and live the rest of her life. If she hadn't been taken from the world, I think that we would all know Karen Stitt's name probably from something else. By the way that she's talked about with her family, she was important to everyone who knew her. She was loved by everyone who knew her. Vibrant. She deserved better.
Thank you, Detective. Thank you for your time today. And most importantly, for this incredible service and this step toward closure for the family and the loved ones of Karen Stitt. And most importantly, for her and her memory. You have done incredible work. And thank you isn't enough, but it's all I've got at this moment. A heart of gratitude for you. It's really been an honor to hear this story from you, sir. And I look forward to having you back to hear about the other cases. You are an incredible detective. Thank you.
I appreciate that very much. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. If you have a story or topic you want to hear on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at truecrimepodcast@fox.com.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.